Good evening. Thank you all for coming. Can you hear me in the back? I'm Jim Burley. I'm from Brookline Booksmith. On behalf of BookSense, The New Yorker, Harvard Bookstore, New Words, Newtonville Books, Wordsworth Books, and Brookline Booksmith, I'd like to welcome you all to the American Repertory Theater. We're very pleased to present Allegra Goodman and Juno Diaz reading from the recent New Yorker 20 Writers for the 21st Century Fiction issue. Many thanks to the five participating BookSense bookstores for their cooperation in this event. BookSense was launched by the American Booksellers Association to build a national identity for independent bookstores, while also celebrating each store's unique character. Starting in September, BookSense will issue gift certificates. You can purchase and redeem it over 1,100 BookSense bookstores in 50 states, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. BookSense will also unveil an e-commerce site in November that will link together participating independent bookstores' websites. You'll be able to browse more than 1.6 million titles and purchase books online. Thank you as well to the New Yorker for their co-sponsorship of tonight's event and for their continuing support of independent bookstores. It's a great honor to have these two exciting authors with us tonight. Allegra Goodman's work has appeared in Slate, Allure, and Vogue, among other magazines. She has been featured in Prize Stories 1995, the O. Henry Awards. She's penned two acclaimed short story collections, Total Immersion and The Family Markowitz. Last year, her novel, Catterskill Falls, was a finalist for the National Book Award. Cynthia Ozick wrote, "Allegra Goodman is brilliant, funny, knowing, alive, a marvel. All the muse fairies were present at her birth." Juno Diaz teaches creative writing at Syracuse University and is a member of Dominicans 2000, a New York City-based community organization. His fiction has also appeared in Story and the Paris Review, and he was included in the Best American Short Stories of 1996. His first short story collection is entitled Drown. Francisco Goldman wrote, "Juno Diaz's stories are as vibrant, tough, unexotic, and beautiful as their settings. Diaz is going to be a giant of American prose." Allegra will read first, and Juno will follow. Both will be reading from stories that appeared in The New Yorker. After they finish, we'll have time for a few of your questions. Copies of their books are for sale tonight in the West Lobby, and both will be available to sign. Please help me welcome Allegra Goodman.
Well, thank you, and thank you for that introduction. And it's great to see all of you here. I'm going to read my story that appeared in this fiction issue of this summer, and it's called The Local Production of Cinderella. You couldn't tell anymore that they had separate desks. For 15 years, Roselva and Helen had worked together at HDHS, the Hawaii Department of Human Services, and their two gray steel desks pushed together in the great hall of the State Administration Building were covered with layers of notes and client files and forms to be filled out. This was 1978, and they worked on twin seafoam green IBM Selectric typewriters. Roselva was Chinese, Hawaiian, Portuguese. She was a religious woman and attended Calvary by the Sea Church. Her skin was deeply tanned, her short hair smooth and black. Her features were soft, as were her eyes. She had a gentle face and was always patient with her clients, whether they were runaways or battered wives, drug-addicted mothers or schizophrenic homeless people. She believed in her job. She believed in human services. Helen, on the other hand, had grown up on the mainland in Maine and was of German Lutheran ancestry. Her skin was fair, her eyes dark, her voice was weary. She talked all the time about how she wanted to leave social work and do something for herself, music or fine cooking or writing. The clients depressed her. She thought some people were just bad. Of all the teams in the Great Hall, Roselva and Helen had been together the longest. They were true partners as they sifted the stacks of paperwork before them. Effortlessly, they plucked forms from their shared mess. Often they took brown bags from their desk drawers and ate lunch together while they worked. On easy days or after home visits, they ate outside, sitting on a dark green bench in Tamarind Park. In the enormous shade of a monkey pod tree, they would talk about Helen's daughters and Roselva's son, Thad, about their husbands and about cleaning house. On this day, at the end of May, walking back to the office after lunch, they crossed South Barricania Street while they talked about Roselva's big night coming up. Thad's girlfriend, Clarice, was a ballet major at Chaminade University and that night she was going to dance the title role in Cinderella. Everybody was going. Roselda's family and Clarice's, Helen and her husband Sid had tickets too. "I'm so nervous," Roselda confessed. "Why?" asked Helen. "You don't have to get up and dance on stage." "I'm nervous for Clarice," Roselda said. "When she gets up there, I'm going to get butterflies for sure. She's my daughter, practically." Helen sighed. For 6 years, Thad and Clarice had been planning to get married. "Have they set a new date?" Helen asked. "No," Roselda said. "I think her parents..." "Yeah, they're pigs," Helen said. She often finished Roselda's sentences, although not with the words Roselda would have chosen. "She's still holding out for the big wedding, huh? Or maybe she doesn't really want to marry Thad." "Of course she does." "Maybe they'll elope," Helen said. Roselda was distracted. She was feeling guilty. That morning, she had read some of Helen's private writing. She had not done anything so clearly wrong since she was a child. She had come into work a few minutes early and put her purse in the file drawer, the way she always did. She began sorting through the papers in the inbox, and there among them was a letter from Helen. It was written in black ink on the good heavyweight bond paper. But it wasn't a letter to Roselda or to anyone in particular. It was addressed, "Dear People of Hawaii." Roselda looked away, then she glanced back. She hesitated just a moment, and then in the empty Department of Human Services, she read the whole thing. Then she read it again. It made her queasy, but she couldn't stop. It was a cuckoo letter, some kind of scary joke. This could not be Helen's writing, she thought. And yet it was her handwriting. This was not the Helen she knew. She wanted to hide the letter somewhere, stuff it away where she couldn't see it. But she put it back where she found it, among the pink, yellow, and white forms on the desk. The letter still sat there when they returned from lunch. Maybe it was a warning sign. Maybe it was a plea for help, in which case Roselda should speak up. That was what she always told her clients' families. First ask if anything is wrong. As soon as Helen got up to go to the ladies' room, Roselda scooted forward in her swivel chair and stood the letter out once more. "Dear People of Hawaii, the missionaries came to Hawaii in their Victorian dresses, whale bones and jet buttons. Imagine the black dresses soaking up the heat. Missionaries planted roses, a buffet for gnats and slugs, caterpillars and aphids, not to mention the black mold. Now the universities plant their sick ideas. People of Hawaii, professors spread their ideology over you each day. They twist your history. Why do you sit silently in the valleys? Why do you sit patiently in the classrooms? Cut the white men down, whether from New York or Michigan. Cut them down and plant them. Let them become succulent plants, night-blooming cereus blooming under the moon, heads of coral for the reef fish. Oh, people of Hawaii, I see your shopping malls and hotel luaus, but then I see your revolution, a red tide, a taste of salt. A new queen rises in the fountain at the foot of Diamond Head. She wears a 12-strand necklace of braided human hair and a pendant of polished ivory. She outlaws ukuleles and slack-key guitars. But will the people rise up from their lay stands by the airport and romp across the asphalt back to the green valleys to reclaim their taro park patches? Will you leave the front desks at the hotel and go back to plait peely grass and hold your ancient games, stick throwing, javelin, smooth black rock bowling, wrestling? Without knowing it, Roselda had begun to read this letter aloud to herself. The queen will die, she whispered. The dolphins will rise up and circle each island. The tide will come in up to the mountaintops. Hotels will dissolve like sand castles. In catamarans, the children will sail from Pearl Harbor, gliding over sunken battleships. Honolulu will become a lost city, whales swishing through lobbies, green sea turtles nosing empty rooms. The great white shark with pinpoint eyes will swim through sunken streets. There will be no humans left, but bones and graves under the water. What was this? What was this writing? It was like a love letter never sent, or a speech Helen never gave. It was a crazy letter, some kind of crazy story. But Helen never acted crazy in real life. She was sarcastic in real life, always talking about her husband, Sid, who taught at the university, and their three teenage daughters. The professor and the princesses, she called them. Helen was cynical, maybe, but she never said a word about the old Hawaii. She talked about old movies at the Honolulu Academy of Arts, Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. This letter wasn't Helen, and the place Helen described, the turtles and the water, what was that place? Not Honolulu. Let me give you a piece of advice, Helen said. Roselva practically jumped out of her chair. Helen was back from the ladies' room. Advice, she asked? If you really want the kids to get married, offer to pay for the wedding. Helen was talking about Thad and Clarice, but Roselva's mind was still with the dolphins and the rising tide. That afternoon, she hung back a little until Helen left. She gathered up the letter along with the other papers on the desk and put the whole pile in her silkscreen orchid-patterned canvas tote bag. Roselva's house was hot. She and her husband, Jimmy, lived in New Valley, and they had glass in the lanai and back. They'd wanted a den, but they got a greenhouse effect. A ranch with three bedrooms and two plumeria trees in front. It was a tract house like every other one in the flat bottom of the valley. Roselva pulled up after work and parked her Dodge Omni in the carport. The car had a pyramidal sign on the roof with student driver on one side and Jimmy's auto school on the other. This was her husband's business, and his car, a green 1975 Pontiac, had a similar sign on its roof. Indoors, Roselva opened the jalousies to cool down the living room and kitchen. Thad was already home. Jimmy would be next. The dance performance was that night, and her best friend was turning crazy on her, as if she didn't have enough to worry about. Of course, who told her to go around reading other people's mail? She stood at the counter, her brain zinging. She tried to cool down and watch Thad eat. He was wearing gym shorts and an ancient t-shirt printed 13th Annual Haleiwa Surfing Classic. Long ago, Clarice's parents, Edwin and Mitsuko, had announced that they were never going to pay for any wedding between Clarice and Thad. Clarice's parents tolerated Thad, but they did not approve of him. They thought their daughter should marry someone with a career, like law or medicine, who could support a ballerina daughter. Clarice's father owned a pool cleaning supply store, and her mother taught the art of ikebana. Thad bolted down his chicken and rice. He got up to look for a glass, then leaned over and drank from the kitchen tap as if it were a water fountain. Thad, Roselva said. Gotta go, Mom, he told her. It's still early yet, she said. Call is 6 o'clock, he told her. He ran out to the driveway and started up Roselva's car. He was taking Clarice down to the theater. Any minute, Jimmy would come home. Roselva changed into a deep green muumuu. She tried to read the newspaper. She opened the refrigerator and checked on the Lay's for Clarice. A three-strand lay of pink Maui rosebuds and a matching haku lay of pink rosebuds, tiny orchids, and ferns woven into a garland. The lays rested on damp paper towels in their clear plastic boxes. The door slammed. It was Jimmy in the living room. She heard him take his keys and wallet and smash them down onto the coffee table. She knew exactly what had happened. Janine Chung had failed her driving test. Patiently, painstakingly, Jimmy had been teaching the student and had brought her along to a point where she was ready to take that exam, more than ready, prepared to ace that driving test. Jimmy had brought her to the DMV, let her take his driving school car out on the test drive with the state examiner, gently pushed his student out of the nest, and the kid had flopped. Randall or Mike or one of the other examiners, Jimmy knew them all, had shuddered in the car and screamed at Janine, never do that! Never, never do that! Return to the testing station! Get out of the vehicle! Zero! You flunk! Jimmy was Janine's instructor, and he was disgraced. Roselva knew how hard this hit him. He was the most careful teacher in the world. He never took a student to the DMV until he or she was a perfect driver. But once in a while, it all went wrong. Jimmy's flawless student driver would get to the test and fall apart, panic while turning left into traffic, fail to line up properly while parking, block an intersection, and turn into a sniveling mess. Jimmy didn't say a word while they ate dinner. He didn't speak as they got into his car and drove to Chaminade. Roselva wanted to tell him what she'd done and ask his advice, but she knew better than to open her mouth. The car jerked ahead in the rush hour traffic. Tight-lipped, Jimmy accelerated to catch the tail end of a green light. They lurched forward. Stop that, Jimmy said to Roselva. Stop what, she asked, and she looked down at her feet. Without realizing it, she had been correcting Jimmy's driving with the car's specially added instructional passenger side brake. Jimmy used the brake all the time to curb his wayward driving students, but he couldn't stand it when Roselva used it on him. When they got to Chaminade, Jimmy let her out in front of the white Spanish Bell auditorium and drove off the park. Thad was waiting outside the auditorium door, and Roselva gave him delays for Clarice. Then she gave the usher her ticket and opened the door to the auditorium. The place was chilly, full of expectant talk. She went down the center aisle, past rows full of people. She was looking for Clarice's parents or for empty seats, but all she found were rows full of strangers and seats that were saved with programs folded over their backs. Then she heard someone calling her down from front. Roselva! Helen was standing there, in the center of the third row. She had saved seats for her and Jimmy. Thad was already sitting next to her. Sid hadn't been able to come, Helen said. Thanks, Roselva squeezed next to Helen. Jimmy's parking. Oh, there he is. Her voice was breathy. She was so nervous. She should say something to Helen. She should speak up right now. The red velvet curtain loomed in front of her. The lights went down. She felt a sympathetic stage fright. When Jimmy took his seat, she said a silent prayer. Lord Jesus, help us. Help Clarice dance and forgive me for what I did today. Show me the way. Music started up from speakers in the wings. The curtains parted, and the Chaminade dance majors appeared. Roselva had to put her glasses on in a hurry. The dancers jumped and pranced to the strains of Prokofiev, some more graceful and some less so. The women, sometimes tall and willowy in their tights and tutus, but sometimes short with big thighs. Roselva's seat was excellent, almost too good. She could see the sweat trickling on the ballerinas' faces, glistening in their hair. When the dancers spun and turned, sweat flew off them as if they had been swimming and had just sprung out of the water. Helen nudged Roselva. There was Clarice. Her body was slender and her skin fair. Her makeup made her look almost European. She had blushing pink cheeks and wide, blue-shadowed eyes. In her costume of gold lace, she descended the grand staircase at the ball. Her black hair was beautifully pinned up, her head suddenly small. When Clarice danced with her prince, she became more ordinary. The prince was a paid ringer from the Honolulu Opera Theater, and he had a distant professional manner. He looked less like an ardent lover than like a seasoned horse trainer as he led Clarice this way and that. Her toe shoes clopped delicately on the wood floor of the stage as he took her through her paces. Oh, poor Thad, Roselva thought. What was he going to do with a dance major? How was he ever going to support her? But then when Clarice went into a solo, Roselva almost forgot her worries. When she sprang up in the air and beat her pointed feet, Roselva cheered silently against gravity. Even when Clarice landed on the ground, she fell back lightly. She was on the verge of flying. Any second it was going to happen. Clarice would become a princess and a bride, the fairy tale star of her dream wedding. All the way home, Roselva wished she had spoken to Helen. There Helen had been all evening, sitting and applauding with her. She had come to Clarice's performance and sat at Roselva's side, and what had Roselva done? Only betrayed her colleague, her friend of 15 years. In the car, Roselva couldn't stop thinking about Helen's words. The missionaries in their Victorian dresses, white men becoming succulent plants. What was that all about? Jimmy, she said, you notice anything different about Helen? No, he said. A red tide and the taste of salt, she thought. The white shark with pinpoint eyes. At home in their bedroom, Roselva changed into her nightgown. Jimmy was lying in his underwear watching the news. His eyes were half closed. Helen wrote me a letter, Roselva said. I never should have read it, but I'm worried. She's sick. You think she's sick? She tapped her head. Jimmy didn't answer. Roselva turned off the television. In a flash, Jimmy opened his eyes. I was watching that, he said. Can I show you this? Roselva took Helen's letter from her bag. She handed Jimmy his reading glasses and he read. He read the whole thing in silence, then handed it back. You sure that's Helen's, he said. It's her handwriting, Roselva said. Maybe she copied it. Where would she copy something like that from? Jimmy shrugged. I just found it on the desk, Roselva said. And now I can't figure out what to do. Put it back, Jimmy suggested. And what if it's some kind of call for help? We just saw her, Jimmy said. He had turned on the news again. His eyes were starting to close. Rosalba bent her head down close to the words in the letter. Then she had an inspiration. "Jimmy," she said, "this letter is a prophecy." "Prophecy for what?" "For the future," Rosalba said. Her voice was hushed. "Look," she said, "the dolphins will rise up. The water will cover the city. There will be no humans left." Jimmy opened his eyes. "What type prophecy is that?" "Armageddon type," Rosalba replied. She lay down on the bed. For the first time that day, she felt some relief. As soon as she came in on Monday morning, Rosalba saw the newspaper clippings on the desk. Helen had clipped the review from her copy of the Sunday paper. "Local production of Cinderella takes wing. Chaminade University's spring offering Cinderella sparkled with innovative choreography, energetic dancing, and dazzling costumes. In the demanding title role, Clarice Leong dances verve and elegant extension. She was a lovely presence on the stage, and we hope to see much more of her in years to come." "Verve," Helen said to Rosalba. "Not bad." "Not too shabby," Rosalba agreed. "But you have to wonder what she's going to do with herself after graduation," Helen said. Rosalba stared at Helen. "That's exactly what I was thinking at the performance." "Poor Thad," Helen said. "Poor Thad. That's just what I was thinking." Rosalba shook her head. But Helen was already at the steel file cabinet gathering folders. They had a visit out to the North Shore. A homeless Tongan family camped out on the beach. Rosalba felt sad whenever they drove out there. The family tent leaked. Dad was always trying to use a payphone up the road to look for work trimming trees. "Don't you start getting down already," Helen said, looking over at her. "I can't believe it," Rosalba said. "You're reading my mind." "Oh, Rosalba, quit it," Helen took out her car keys. "I mean, I read your letter," Rosalba took it out of her bag and placed it on Helen's desk. "I'm sorry," she said. For just a second, Helen was taken aback. Then she shrugged. "My shrink says I should write. He says I have a lot of anger. I'm working on that." "You're blessed," Rosalba said. "Yeah, I guess," Helen said. "I'm blessed with a lousy marriage, scum for clients, a daughter sleeping with her entire senior class." "You're blessed with prophecy," Rosalba said. "You see how it's all going to be." "Oh, Rosalba," Helen said. "I can't see two steps in front of me." Rosalba shook her head. "Look at this." She picked up Helen's letter. "No more selling lace. Whales in the lobby." Helen took the letter, crumpled it up, and tossed it in the trash bin next to her desk. Rosalba blinked. She nearly went to fish the letter out again. "That's just made up," Helen said. "None of that's going to happen." "No, no," Rosalba insisted. "You have the gift. You know the future." "Fine, if you believe that kind of thing. It's like you believe in angels and heaven and hell." "I do," Rosalba said. Helen shrugged. "Okay, I'm not going to argue with you." "And what do you believe?" "When you're dead, you're dead," Helen said. "That's the beauty of it. You just stop."
"And then what?"
"Then nothing."
"I can't believe that's true." "That's why they invented Helen. That's why they invented heaven," Helen said.
"It's not," Rosalba said. "Okay, whatever you say," said Helen. "Listen, if you get up there, I'll go with you." "But not too soon," Rosalba said.
"It'll be like this," Helen said, and she leaned close. Rosalba looked at her earnestly, just a little bit on guard, since Helen loved to make fun. And Helen said in her weary, half-serious voice, "We'll grow very old, and we'll go to heaven in clouds of smoke, or to the shark place. Wherever we go, we'll kick off our shoes, and it'll all be the same. I'm still going to be working with you."
Thank you.
Thank you, Allegra Goodman. And now, Juno Diaz. Please welcome him.
Actually, it's a story I've been working on for a while, and it's called Nilda. That's it. Nilda was my brother's girlfriend. This is how all these stories begin. She was Dominican from here and had super long hair like those Pentecostal girls and a chest you wouldn't believe. I'm talking world class. Rafa would sneak her down into our basement after our mother went to bed and do her to whatever was on the radio right then. The two of them had to let me stay because if my mother heard me upstairs on the couch, everybody's ass would have been fried. And since I wasn't about to spend my night out in the bushes, this is how it was. Rafa didn't make no noise, just a low something that resembled breathing. Nilda was the one. She seemed to be trying to hold back from crying the whole time. It was crazy hearing her like that. The Nilda I'd grown up with was one of the quietest girls you'd ever met. She let her hair wall away her face and liked to read the New Mutants. And the only time she looked straight at anything was when she looked out a window. But that was before she'd gotten that chest, before that slash of black hair had gone from something to pull on in the bus to something to pull on in the dark. The new Nilda had already run away from her mother's house and ended up in a group home. She'd already slept with a bunch of guys from Parkwood. She crashed over our apartment a lot because she hated her mother, who was the neighborhood periquera. In the morning, she slipped out before my mom woke up and waited for heads at the bus stop and fronted like she'd come from her own place, like she had a normal home life. She had a sad moon face and the driest skin and was always rubbing lotion on it. These are the technical discs. I'm saving you, sparing you pages here. You'll all thank me at the end. The only reason my brother went after her was because his last full-time girlfriend had gone back to Guyana and because Nilda had pushed up on him. She'd only been back from a group home a couple of months, but by then she'd already gotten a rep. A lot of the Dominican girls in town were on some serious fucking lockdown. We saw them on the bus and at school and maybe at the Pathmark. But since most of the families knew exactly what kind of guys were roaming the neighborhoods, these girls weren't allowed out too much. Nilda, though, was different. Her mother was a drunk and was always running around South Amboy with her white boyfriends, which is a long way of saying that Nilda could hang out with us. Almost immediately after she got back into town, she was scooped up by this older cat from the back apartments. He kept her on his dick for almost 4 months, and I used to see them driving around in his fucked up, rusty and sunburned while I delivered my newspapers. The motherfucker was like 300 years old. But because he had a car and all these old albums he used to play for her, Nilda was all lost on him. I used to ask her, what's up with wrinkled dick? And she would get so mad she wouldn't speak to me for a couple of days. And then I would get this note, I want you to respect my man. And I would write back, whatever. Then the old cat bounced. No one knew where, the usual scenario in my neighborhood, and she got tossed by a couple of these niggas from Parkwood, Donio and his gang. And the only time, Donio and his gang. On comic book days, though, she'd drop in to see what I'd picked up, and she'd talk to me about how unhappy she was. We'd sit together until it got dark, and then her beeper would fire up, and she'd peer into its display and say, I have to go. And sometimes I could grab her and pull her back on the couch and say no, but other times she'd be real serious. I have to go see my man. One of those comic book days, she saw my brother coming back from one of his 5-mile runs. Rafa was still boxing in those days, and he was cut up like crazy. The muscles on his chest and abdomen so striated, they looked like something out of a Frazetta drawing. And he noticed her because she was wearing these ridiculous shorts and this tank that couldn't have blocked a sneeze. And a thin roll of her stomach was poking happily from between the fabrics. And he smiled at her, and she got real serious and uncomfortable. And he told her to fix him some iced tea, and she told him to fix it himself. You're a guest here, he said. You should be earning your fucking keep. He went into the shower, and as soon as he did, she was in the kitchen stirring. And I told her to leave it, but she said, I might as well. We drank all of it anyway. The next day, my brother took the bus to school, and when he was walking past our seat, he took her hand and pulled her to her feet, and she said, "Get off me." Her eyes were pointed straight into the ground. "I just want to show you something," he said. She was pulling with her arm, but the rest of her was ready to get out of her seat. "Come on," Rafa said, and finally she went. "Save my seat," she said over her shoulder, and I was like, "Oh yeah." Before we even swung onto 516, Nilda was in my brother's lap, and he had his hand so far up her skirt, it looked like he was performing a surgical procedure. When we were getting off the bus, Rafa pulled me aside and held his hand in front of my nose. "Smell this," he said. "It doesn't smell too good, does it?" This is how I remember my brother in those days. You couldn't get anywhere near Nilda the rest of the day. She had her hair pulled back and was glorious in triumph. Even the white girls knew about my brother. They were impressed. And while Nilda sat at the end of our lunch table and whispered to some of her girls, me and my boys ate our crap sandwiches and talked about the X-Men. This was back when the X-Men still made some kind of sense. And even if we didn't want to admit it, the truth was now patent and awful. All the real dope girls were headed up to the higher school, like moths to a light, and there was nothing none of us younger cats could do about it. My man, Jose Negron, a.k.a. Joe Black, took Nilda's defection the hardest, since he's actually imagined that he had a chance with her. Once, years ago, when nobody had thought Nilda anything, he'd held her hand on the bus and never forgotten. I was in the apartment 3 nights later when they did it. The first time, neither of them made a sound. They went out the whole summer, the last summer any of us were normal. I don't remember anybody doing much of anything. Me and my pathetic little crew hiked over to Morgan Creek and swam around in water that stank of leachate gas from the landfill. We were just getting serious about the liquor that year, and Joe Black was stealing bottles out of his father's stash, and we were drinking them down to the corners on the swing behind the apartments. Because of the heat, and because of what I felt inside, there's a whole group of people I haven't looked at. Scary. Because of the heat, and because of what I felt inside my chest a lot of the time, I sat in the crib with my brother and with Nilda. That summer, Rafa was tired all the time and pale. I used to say, "Look at you, white boy." And he used to say, "Look at you, nigger." He didn't feel like doing much. And besides, his car had finally broke down for real. So we would all sit in the air-conditioned apartment and watch television. Rafa had decided he wasn't going back to school the next year. And even though my mother was heartbroken and trying to guilt him out of it 5 times a day, this was all he talked about. School had never been his gig. And after my father disappeared, he didn't feel like he needed to pretend any longer. "I'd like," he said, "to take a long fucking trip. See California before it slides into the ocean." "California," I said. "Yeah," he said. "A nigga could really make a showing out there." "I'd like to go out there too," Nilda said. But Rafa didn't answer her. He had his eyes closed, and you could see he was in pain. We never talked about our father. I'd asked Rafa once, right at the beginning of the last great absence, where he thought our father was, and Rafa said, "Like, I fucking care." End of conversation, world without end. On days niggas were really out of their minds with boredom, we trooped down to the pool and got in for free, because Rafa was boys with one of the lifeguards. I swam, Nilda went on missions around the pool just so she could show off how tight she looked in her bikini, and Rafa sprawled out under the awning and watched. Sometimes he'd call me over and we'd sit together for a while, and then he'd tell me to go back into the pool. When Nilda finished promenading and came back to where Rafa was laid out, she kneeled at his side and he would kiss her real long, his hands playing up and down the length of her back. Those hands seemed to be saying, at least to me, there ain't nothing like a 15-year-old girl with a banging body. Joe Black watched them always. Maybe I thought they would have been cute if I hadn't known my brother. He might have seemed in love with Nilda, but he also had mad girls in orbit, like this one piece of white trash from Sayreville who had gotten him open at the Route 1 flea market, like this other girl from Amsterdam Village, a morena who also slept over and sounded like a freight train when they did it. I don't remember her name either, but I do remember how her perm shone in the glow of our nightlight. In August, Rafa quit his job at the carpet factory. "I'm too fucking tired," he complained. And on some mornings, his leg bones hurt so much he couldn't get out of bed. "The Romans," I said, "used to shatter those with iron clubs. It killed you instantly." "Great," he said. "Cheer me up some more, you fucking bastard." My mom, who'd been watching him the whole time, finally forced him to go to the clinic. But this doctor was one of those assholes who couldn't give a fuck about us niggas and said Rafa was only a little bit anemic. Mommy didn't believe her, but she didn't have no money for a second opinion. That was the summer when everything we would become was hovering just over our heads. Girls were starting to take notice of me. I wasn't good looking, but I listened and was sincere and had boxing muscles on my arms. In another universe, I probably came out okay. Ended up with mad girls and mad jobs and a sea of love in which to swim in. But in this world, I had a brother who was dying of cancer, and a long, dark patch of life was waiting for me up ahead like a mile of black ice. One night, a couple of weeks before school started, they must have thought I was asleep. Nilda started telling Rafa about her plans for the future. I think even she knew what was about to happen. Listening to her, imagining herself was about the saddest thing you ever heard. How she wanted to get away from her mother and open up a group home for runaway kids. "But this one would be real cool," she said. "It would be for normal kids who just got problems." She would tell me about her idea later when me and her spent an afternoon together waiting for the New York bus. But that night she was only talking to Rafa. She must have loved him because she went on and on. Plenty of people talk about having a flow, but that night I really heard one, something that was unbroken, that fought itself and worked together all at the same time. Rafa didn't say nothing. Maybe he had his hands in her hair, or maybe he was just like, "Fuck you." When she finished, he didn't even say, "Wow." I wanted to hide myself in embarrassment. About a half hour later, she got up and dressed. I didn't have to turn my head to watch her. She couldn't see me, or she would have known that I thought her beautiful. She had her face down and her hair in front of it. She stepped into her pants and pulled them up in one motion, sucked in her stomach while she buttoned them. "I'll see you later," she said. "Yeah," he said. After she walked out, he put on the radio and started on the speed bag. I stopped pretending I was asleep. I sat up and watched him. "Did you guys have a fight or something?" "Nope." "Why'd she leave?" He sat down on the bed. "She had to go." "But where is she going to stay?" "I don't know." He put his hand on my face gently. "Why ain't you minding your own fucking business?" A week later, he was seeing some other girl. She was from Trinidad, and she had this phony as hell English accent. It was the way we all were back then. None of us wanted to be niggers, not for nothing. I guess 2 years passed. My brother was gone by then, and I was on my way to becoming a nut. Nilda didn't fare so hot either. A lot of the things that happened to her, though, had nothing to do with me or my brother. She fell in love a couple more times, real bad with this one Moreno truck driver who took her to Manalapan and then abandoned her at the end of the summer. I had to drive to get her, and the house was one of those tiny brick jobs with a 50-cent lawn and no kind of charm. And she was acting like she was some Italian girl and offered me a smoke in the car, but I wasn't smoking at all in those days, and put my hand on hers and told her to stop it. Once she got back, she fell in love with more stupid niggas, relocated from the city, and they came at her with some stupid drama, and some of their girls beat her up, a real beat down, and she lost her bottom front teeth. She was in and out of school for a while, they put her on home instruction, and that's when she dropped. My junior year, she started delivering papers so she could make money, and since I was spending a lot of time outside, I saw her every now and then. It broke my fucking heart. She wasn't at her lowest yet, but she was aiming there. And when we passed each other, she always smiled and said hi. Sometimes she even said my real name. She was starting to put on weight, and she'd cut her hair down to nothing, and her moon face was heavy and alone. I always said, what's up? And when I had cigarettes, I gave them to her. These things, she said, holding them in her fingers, these things are ruthless. She'd gone to the funeral along with a couple of his other girls, and what a skirt she'd worn, like maybe she could still convince him of something. And she kissed my mother, but the vieja hadn't known who she was. I had to tell her on the ride home, and all she could remember about her was that she was the one who smelled good. It wasn't until Mommy said it that I realized that it was true. It was only one summer, and she was nobody special, so what's the point in all of this? He's gone, he's gone. I'm 23, and I'm washing my clothes up at the mini mall on Ernston Road. They closed all the apartment laundries the year before because of the robberies. She's here with me. She's folding her shit and smiling and showing me her missing teeth and saying, it's been a long time, hasn't it, Junior? Years, I say. Outside, the sky is swept of gulls, and down at the apartment, my mom is waiting for me with dinner. 6 months earlier, we were sitting in front of the TV, and my mother said, well, I think I'm finally over this place. Did you move or something? I shake my head. I've just been working. God, it's been a long, long time. She's on her clothes like magic, making everything neat, making everything fit. There are a couple of other people at the counters, broke-ass looking brothers, with knee socks and croupier's hats and scars snaking up arms and spotting legs, and they all seem like sleepwalkers compared to her. She shakes her head, grinning. Your brother, she says. Rafa, I say. She points her finger at me like my brother always did. I miss him sometimes, I say. She nods. Me too. He was a good guy to me. I say, Nilza. I must have the disbelief on my face because she finishes shaking out her towels and then stares straight through me. He treated me the best, you know. Nilza, I repeat. He used to sleep with my hair over his face. He used to hold my hand when we drove. What else can I say to that? She finishes her stacking. I hold the door open to her. The locals watch us leave. We walk back through the old neighborhood. Nila is watching the ground as though she's afraid she might fall. Her hair is pointing straight down like a compass needle. London Terrace has changed now that the landfill has been shut down. Kicked up rent and mad South Asian people and white folks living in the apartments too. But it's our kids you see in the streets, hanging from the porches. Remember the day we met, she asked. I say, yeah. You wanted to play baseball. It was summer, I say. You were wearing a tank top. Yeah, she said. You made me put on a shirt before you'd let me be on your team. Do you remember? And I said, yeah, I remember. We never spoke again. I went away to college, and I don't know where the fuck she went. That's all. Thank you.